Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Jean Thomas. We're here today with Caleb White. Caleb is the owner of New Leaf Tree Service in Chatham, New York. We as master gardeners always receive tree questions, and so we're so excited to have Caleb here to talk about tree selection, planting, and maintenance. Welcome, Caleb.
Hi, Jean. Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
We are really excited to have Caleb here, and Caleb's the owner of New Leaf Tree Service. Tell us about how you got involved with trees. Were you like a tree kid? Did you climb trees? Do you love trees? Or is it just a happenstance thing? Because I know there's a rumor that you have a history in recording.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I was always a tree kid per se. I spent a lot of time outside in my youth. I was big into athletics, so cross-country trails in the fall, and then a lot of indoor sports through college. I went to SUNY Purchase and studied studio composition there for 4 years.
He's our new intern, I think.
And also spent a lot of time working in the athletic department there. But really, my interest in trees developed after college, partly out of luck, partly out of just determination to use my hands and use carpentry skills, contracting skills, things like that. So ultimately, I had an opportunity to join a crew that was traveling to outside of Washington, D.C. to prepare a forest for an aerial adventure park. So if you're not familiar with those, it's, you know, zip lines and platforms and trees and all these different types of courses for differing ability levels, things like that. And so that was my real introduction into forestry work and also risk assessment and evaluation of trees and an appreciation of trees. You know, there's nothing like, learning how to climb in a forest of 200-foot tulip poplars and building platforms 80 feet high up in the air when you're hanging from a rope in a harness. It's pretty spectacular. So from there, I had a business partner, Peter Madsen, when we started the business. We were both from the Chatham area, so we settled back here and began New Leaf Tree Services as two guys working out of the back of a pickup truck.
Have you been to Catamount?
Yeah, we were involved with Catamount pretty early on. I wasn't part of the initial building, but we did tree maintenance there over the years. Peter and I, once we started the company, got hired to go through and pruned almost every platform tree in that park, as well as did some upgrades at certain times. This was all back in like the 2010, 2012 timeframe back then.
I got trapped in one of those.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, fat ladies shouldn't be riding things like that.
Yeah, I took my family there one time and we had a great time, but it was an experience, just the difference between my father doing some zip lines and my nieces. And my niece loved it. My father, we tried to do some things. It was a little bit more challenging.
So. And Catamount's right nearby, so it's a day trip.
Yeah, totally.
For any of us here.
I mean, Jiminy Peak has a great one, too. And there was one summer where I was working with a coworker of mine and we traveled around. We spent a month at Jiminy Peak doing maintenance there, and then we spent the rest of the summer up in New Hampshire. Met a couple of ski resorts up there, building parks up there.
So you mentioned risk assessment, and that is a big part of tree services, right? It's about really thinking about, is a tree going to fall on someone, and safety and things like that. I think it's something that people don't really think about that much, right?
Yeah, the ISA, International Society of Arboriculture, came out with a specific qualification for that. I think they introduced it 5 or 6 years ago. I went and did a two-day course and did an exam with that to get that qualification. And it centers around being able to evaluate the potential for risk and then consequences that would come along with potential failure and being able to put that in a way that can be communicated to homeowners.
And so that's a piece of your service, but tell us, just kind of backing way up, like, tell us about your service. What do you provide besides trimming and cutting down trees? You also do planting and things like that, right?
Yeah, we do we call it full service tree care. So removals are obviously a part of that. We specialize in those kind of higher risk, more challenging removals. We have a lot of really nimble equipment that can help us get into tight places and be really gentle with properties. So we really like these track lifts that they make. They look like spiders when they're deployed up on their four outriggers.
They're pretty
fantastic. You know, Peter and I started out climbing, and while climbing is still the basis for a lot of how tree work is done, working from a platform, especially one that allows you to be so nimble and gentle with the landscape, can provide the opportunity to reach things that you couldn't reach before. In our area with, you know, the dead ash and elm and things like that, to not have to make those decisions to go into potentially dangerous situations is really important. So making the transition to that lift was just a big boost for our business. And since we went with the first one back in 2016, now we have two of these track lifts. So we have one that can go 100 feet up in the air and really get us into some great situations. So, you know, removals are a core of what we do. We do a lot with pruning, ornamental pruning, primarily in the winter seasons, but also a little bit in the summer, depending on the need and intention as far as pruning goes. We do a lot with canopy reduction pruning. So along those lines of, you know, going along with risk assessment, you know, if there's a situation where there's a vulnerable junction in a tree or just a lot of weight over a structure, we'll go in a very thoughtful way, work the outer edges of a canopy to lessen the load, lessen the length of branches while still maintaining the character of the tree. And then, of course, also taking the dead limbs out is important too.
Okay, we skipped a step. Gene needs definitions. You're an arborist.
Yep.
Define that.
So the International Society of Arboriculture, about 30 years ago, I think it was in 1992, created a certification that they expanded to be worldwide. You have to meet certain criteria to be eligible to take the exam. You have to pass an exam to receive that certification. And then you do continuing education courses or classes. And you have to recertify every 3 years with a minimum number of credits. So it's, you know, it's establishing a benchline for knowledge every arborist should have, and then making sure that you're staying current with pests, diseases, practices, safety measures, things like that throughout the industry.
So could we give you a tree ID quiz out in the winter in the woods, and you could ID all those trees from bark or limbs or whatever?
Yeah, given proper context, I've gotten pretty good at that. In the beginning, you know, there's so much to learn, but more and more every year you pick up these little kind of tips and notice certain things, and it's gotten to the point where you can be out walking with a client and go like, oh, that's a sugar maple. Oh, that's a silver maple. Oh, that's a red maple. And they're going, how do you know that? And it's like, well, I just kind of know based on the structure, the way the buds look.
Of course, the beauty is they don't know if you know.
Well, occasionally you have that client like Tim where you got to really be on your game.
Not in the winter. It's hard in the winter. But you said something about the canopy, which I thought was really interesting. And I guess my question for you is, how would I even know as a homeowner if there was a canopy issue with my tree? Like, how, when you get a call from someone, what is it usually about? Is it about my tree's dying, or I think it's going to fall on the house? Or like, what's the most common thing you get from clients?
Yeah, the most common thing we get is either people are usually reactionary. So they usually either have a storm event or something fails or a branch falls, and they kind of take a look around and they realize that they haven't really thought about this element of their property before, and they're just looking for an assessment or you know, a trained eye to have a look around and see what can be done. What we really love is when we get like a new homeowner or someone who's new to the area and doesn't really know the trees or the property very well. We love these 45-minute walk-arounds where we can walk and talk, answer questions, point things out, identify potential issues. For anybody who is newly purchasing a home who doesn't have a history with the property, I think first and foremost, just evaluating the trees that are around structures, along driveways, by parking areas, playgrounds, places in the yard that you're going to be spending time. I think it's good to have a benchmark to start from, even if there's no work that has to be done, just so that you can have that good start going forward to work with.
And you're willing to go out and talk to a client even if the end result is right now you're not going to do trimming, but maybe somewhere in the future you are, but you're going to have that conversation with them about
their absolutely.
Trees.
Yeah. We charge for initial consultations with new clients. And so there's, you know, a couple different choices on our website for the amount of time that you can book. And I'm very forthcoming with, you know, opinions on what should or shouldn't be done. You know, when it comes to risk assessment, as part of the training, you're really guided to not tell someone what to do. And that's something that I try very hard to do. Of course, inevitably people say, well, what would you do if this were your tree? And so, you know, if it's a white pine next to your house, I usually offer an opinion and tends to move towards removal. But it is really important for people to have, you can't even say the facts, because we're talking about nature here. You can't predict everything. But what we can do is we can evaluate a tree. We can look for a cavity. We can see if there's dead limbs. We can work from experience and say, yeah, we've seen things like this fail in the past. This is something that I would really strongly consider dealing with. Or, you know, we see things like this all the time. Primarily, these things stay standing. Of course, in a big storm, all bets are off. But, you know, I really don't think you need to act on something like this. Or maybe this is priority number three on a list.
Yeah, I have to say, I think that's what I liked the most when you came out to my property and you basically said, this can be, you know, held off for a year or two, or it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, let's cut everything down or let's prune everything. It was really, it's consultative, right? It's really about what you might plan for the next couple of years, even.
Years, decades, yeah, everything. I mean, that's been our whole approach right from the start, has been, you know, we don't need to make the quick buck now. We're about building relationships, getting to know people's land, people's trees. Just like you guys, we love trees. We don't take satisfaction in taking them down. We like that we do it well, but we much prefer to try to save a tree through pruning or through other practices if possible. So,
okay, I'm one of those new homeowners, and I've just wandered in, and I'm looking at some of these trees, and they look like they got like too many branches, and I'm kind of worried about that. So I call you up, and you tell me if I need to remove it or prune it, or can I ask you for an opinion and get a hypothetical answer?
I mean, it all becomes really fluid and conversational on the site. You know, our typical walkarounds are 45 minutes, and, you know, usually there's four or five trees around a house of varying species, and we'll talk about branch structure, trunk structure. We'll look for codominant stems, you know, where you have multiple stems emanating from a single trunk. We'll look for potential problem areas like included bark or branch ratios that are over a half to one, meaning the smaller the size of the branch coming off the main trunk, typically the better the branch connection. So we'll look for things like that. We'll look for cavities. We'll look for mushrooms. We'll look for bird activity within the trees. And we'll look at the species that are around too. And we'll make conversationally judgments about those trees and kind of work on a plan going forward. It's also about me getting to know what my clients' relationship is with their property. You know, we have certain people who say, I don't care what the hazard is. I love this tree. I'm not cutting it down. And it's important for me to get to know that about these people so that I don't just say, you know, let's cut this tree down. I'm happy working within those confines as long as everyone is on the same page about what the potential hazards could be. And once we've established this tree's not going anywhere, then we can look at what we can do to work with the tree within that construct.
It's the same true when people are thinking about planting trees, because you plant trees too, right? I mean, so how do you, is it a similar process? Somebody calls you and says, I want to plant a tree in this area. I want it to be a shade tree. I mean, is it the same consultative in terms of what species you're going to suggest?
It can be. Yeah, I think it's about 50-50 when we get requests for planting trees. 50% of the time people know, I want evergreens and I want a hedge, or I need to screen this, or we just lost this sugar maple and now we want to plant one or two or three to replace it. But ultimately, we are getting to know what our clients' interests are. How they use the property is really important. what vantage points they're going to be observing these things, long-term goals in terms of access.
Are you seeing trends in terms of what people want to plant or what they want to do on their properties? Is there an it tree these days, or, you know, it trees?
I would say the trend that we've seen, especially with this influx of people moving into the area, is with screening. And screening's a really difficult thing to plant for. A lot of the trees that people typically want to see used as screens are evergreen because they want that year-long screening. And almost all of the evergreens that we naturally have growing in our area, the native trees, don't like to be planted closely together. And there are also pests, specifically with spruce and hemlock, that are affecting those trees. So we are trending away from those species. You know, white pine is a great choice for an evergreen, but it's not typically something you would see in a screen planting or in a hedge. So dealing with the challenges, working with our clients, maybe discussing, you know, some type of artistic fence or wooden structure, not as a blockade, but as something that can add some seasonal interruption of the eye, can really open up the planting palette to include deciduous, ornamental flowering trees, shrubs, along with a couple of selectively placed trees. So we really try to get into the minute details of why the screen is needed, what we're trying to screen, when does it have to be effective, and can we be a little bit more creative with what we're planting.
And do you install the fence too? Is that something you do as part of your service?
Typically, no. But on the landscape front, we do see that, you know, both with deer, but also with screening, adding that to what we offer is certainly something that we're looking to add this season.
Oh, we got to talk.
And I assume people ask for deer-resistant species too, since the concentration of deer in Columbia County is so high.
Yeah, deer are a real problem with plantings. Deer-resistant,
there is not, no such thing, right?
No, yeah. And that's what we tell people. Yeah. We say even the trees that are least likely to be eaten by deer in a certain winter at a certain time, we've seen them nibbled as well. I have clients who, you know, had 50-foot tall white pines with branches to the ground that went away a couple of years ago over Christmas. They were gone for 2 weeks. They came back and the bottom 4 feet were eaten off these trees, and they were
white pines.
Screens.
Yeah,
white pines that were very mature, had never been touched before. So with all plantings, we would suggest either a temporary deer fence or considering some kind of larger, more semi-permanent or permanent deer fence, depending on the landscape and how it's intended to be used. But we haven't found that we've had any success deterring deer from touching plants without a fence.
Okay, I've got a question. You got somebody calls up, they say they've got a bunch of trees and they want you to plant them. And you get there and you look at the trees and they're totally freaking wrong. What do you do?
Good question. Most of the time we're involved before the trees are there.
Fortunately.
Yes. We very rarely take jobs where people have already purchased the trees. Usually we're trying to steer people towards certain nurseries where we know the quality of the stock is good. We're also trying to steer people towards bald and burlapped or bare root as opposed to potted. And I think your average homeowner, if they're out on the weekend looking at trees, they're most likely to come home with some potted material. So if we get those calls, it's not that we won't engage with those clients, but we would much prefer to be engaged from the start, assist with the selection of trees, and then we handle everything. We have our list to go search the local nurseries to see what is available. We put together those proposals. If our clients want to move forward with it, we reserve that material. We pick it up. We deliver it. We
I
do
love
everything.
You.
Wait a minute. You just said something about potted, though. Like, why are you hesitant to plant potted trees? Because the roots are not developed well or something like that? They get twined around each other? Or what's the story with potted?
Exactly. Yeah. We've seen that most potted nursery stocks, specifically the plastic pots that you would commonly find at most of your local nurseries, most of those plants, whether they be trees or shrubs or even herbaceous plants, are root-bound. Usually they've been left in the pots too long, and those roots have hit the edges of the pot and started to circle around. Long-term, that causes a big problem with the establishment of trees in their new landscape that they're installed in. They just do not establish at the same rate with the same vigor. And long term, you will have or potentially could have issues with girdling roots that can then reflect damage in the canopy.
I think I've been doing it wrong all along, Gene. I've got girdling roots.
That explains a lot. Yeah. Girdling is going on.
I do, yeah. No, but that's really interesting because there's so many nurseries. I mean, most of their stock is in plastic pots, right? Many of them.
We're actually running an experiment right now. We have about 2,000 native trees and shrubs that we have planted in these fabric root pouches above ground, and they're healed in with wood chips this winter. Now, it's a bit of an experiment. We'll see what the survival is like. Obviously, it'll depend a little bit on the winter. But the idea with these root pouches, and that's the name of the product, they're called root pouches, is that they prune the roots of these plants when they hit the edge of the pot through what's called entrapment pruning, which doesn't kill off that stem. It just makes it dormant, essentially, and sends a message back through that stem to send out another root. So you end up with a very fibrous root system that is outgrowing, that does not hit the edge of the pot and circle around, which when planted should leave a specimen that will transplant and establish much quicker and with much more vigor.
Is it a chemical reaction?
No.
It's the fabric itself.
It's more of a physical reaction.
Oh, that's neat.
I mean, it's similar to the concept with air pruning, which is a common nursery pot, or you can do air prune beds when you're growing out like hickories or other heavily tap-rooted trees.
Is this biodegradable material, or is it something you take out of the pouch?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not biodegradable. You have to cut the pouch off when you plant it. The pouches are made out of, I think it's 25 or 50% recycled material. But yeah, no, that we looked into biodegradable pots and pouches, things like that. But you get much less grow time in those bags. And fundamentally, I would be concerned about planting something in the ground that relies on that product degrading before the roots have free rein to enter their new soil. I think any inhibition to newly planted roots establishing as quickly as possible can slow the establishment of the tree.
I mean, well, B&B can do that too, the Ball and Burlap.
Yeah,
I've seen.
Honestly, there is still a lot of debate. I know of a lot of companies and people who do still sometimes leave the burlap on or leave the cages on, and there are usually varying explanations for that. And I know that there have been studies done that include pull tests and other tests that establish whether or not a tree has survived or done well in its new environment. Fundamentally, it just doesn't make sense why you would leave the burlap on. The roots get constrained behind that burlap. They cannot get out into their new soil. And if you think about what you're doing when you're taking a bald and burlapped tree, you know, say your average white pine we might plant is like 10 feet tall. And that's a trunk diameter that can be 5 or 6 inches, you know, at the base. The root ball of that is 3 to 4 feet across. Well, in the field where that was grown, the root system was expanding out from the trunk at least as far as the tree was tall. And you have severely diminished that root ball in its transport. And so that's a lot of water that has to be constantly added to those roots to keep that tree alive. So your primary goal when you plant it is to get those roots to establish and start to expand exponentially as quickly as possible, so that it can become more resilient and not be as reliant on additional water as quickly as possible.
Okay, that brings the next question. You've brought the plants, you've planted them, they're all beautiful, you've got all the mulch down and everything. What is the homeowner's responsibility? You're going to have to water that baby for a while. Is that part of your service, that you have a maintenance thing set up, or is it an available thing? Or do you trust the homeowner to get their butt out there and water the plants?
It works all sorts of ways. It is a service that we offer. You know, first off, fundamentally, I don't guarantee the trees that we plant. And that, again, differs to some things that other people do. You know, you can go to some of the bigger box stores and they'll guarantee the plant, which, you know, at a base level to me just doesn't make any sense. And for a local person who does installations, if you plant to a high level of quality and you have good attention to detail in terms of the selection of the plant, and if you're buying it from a reputable nursery, survival of the plant at a certain point just comes down to whether they get enough water and, to a certain extent, luck. You know, there is an expectation that you're going to lose about 10% of transplanted material. It could be a little higher, could be lower. But, you know, if we did a planting that had 10 to 20 trees, and if we only lost one tree out of those 20, I'd be pretty thrilled by that. But to backtrack to your question, is it the homeowner's responsibility? You know, we give detailed instructions as to how much water trees should get. That first month is the most critical. And depending on the season, depending on the temperature, and depending on the rainfall that we're naturally getting, you might need to be watering as much as daily for that first month.
Like last summer.
Yeah, last summer was super dry and trees really needed a lot of water. It's really the first year that's the most important. After that first year, unless you hit an extreme drought, the tree should be established enough to get the water resources that they need. The other thing I'll say is there's this product that we've started using more and more called the tree diaper. Tim, I don't know, Gene, if you're...
I don't think we talked about tree diapers.
I don't know if you're familiar with those.
I'm familiar with them, but I don't talk about it.
They're fantastic. They, you know, you soak them to essentially fill these pouches with water. You would lay them down underneath the mulch. The water is then slowly released over time. And whenever you have a water event, whether it's rain or in the spring, it could be melting snow, it could be runoff, that water will get reabsorbed. The excess will get reabsorbed and then slowly released. And we've had great success. We've seen higher levels of success in transplanting when these products have been used. And it also helps to suppress weeds around the base of the trees too.
So it is really like a diaper, right? You want a diaper now, don't you, Jane? You right? Right? You're looking very excited.
There's a large silence, right?
So I have a question, though, from what you were just... We've had such unusual weather, and, you know, a lot of it because of climate change, really, you know, heavy rains and then drought. And so are you recommending different species of trees because of the, you know, the way the weather has been, the climate has been? And are you, you know, moving more towards natives, or how does that work in terms of your kind of seeing what's happening with climate change?
Well, first off, we really are intently focused on planting native species. We actually will refuse jobs or pass on jobs at this point that don't involve those. But we will also work with potential clients if they have a certain tree in mind that isn't native, you know, like a Japanese maple or a
corkscrew willow.
Or a Bradford pear.
Bradford pear. Oh,
oh my goodness.
Get just cut it down. Just cut it down.
So we'll work with them to offer native options that will better benefit our insects and our ecology. When it comes to climate change, you know, I think we do have an eye towards the future in terms of what we would anticipate will do better. The biggest differences, like I said earlier, are we're really not planting many spruce anymore. They don't seem to be tolerating this environment in the winter that doesn't include as much cold weather. I think there's a belief that fungal and insect issues are not being controlled by weather as much as maybe they previously had been. So we're really moving away from those. And in terms of deciduous, you know, I think we were anticipating that the oaks and the hickories and, you know, even things like black gum are going to start to kind of become more prominent and could...
I mean, sugar maples, I've been hearing, are not doing as well because they like it colder as we get warmer. And certainly something like a larch, I would assume you wouldn't consider planting because they're, again, it's getting warmer in the winters and the summers.
Yeah, we with the sugar maples, again, an interesting debate. We had been trending more towards red maple, and I've appreciated red maples more lately because I think I've seen better fall color out of them, and that might just be a personal opinion. And we do see a lot of decline in mature sugar maples. We're seeing a lot of dieback in the upper portions of the canopy and decay in the trunks. I think at this point it's preemptive to say don't plant sugar maple. Because, you know, my hope is that they will adapt. But if people are interested in looking towards a different maple variety, I think red maple is a great choice, and it is native. We use a lot of red maples because we're often looking for trees that'll do better in a little bit wetter of an environment, and they're a great option in those types of situations.
And they're native all down the East Coast, so yep. It's kind of, you know, that if the warm weather is coming, they're probably still going to thrive here.
Exactly. The only difference that we view between them, well, not the only difference, one of the main differences between them and sugar maples is we try to keep the red maples a little bit further away from structures because they do tend to lose branches a little bit more often. The quality of the wood is different than a the strength in a sugar maple.
Tell me you don't put in silver maples.
No, we don't plant silver maples.
Well,
we take a lot of silver maples down.
I'll bet. They're terrible, brittle.
I know Caleb is planting Norway maples all the time.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, right next to the silver.
That's the first thing I took him to at my house. Please cut these down.
I was considering a bounty program on Norway maples.
Oh, I like that. Ooh, I like
there's
that.
There's a thought. Yeah. A discount for every third one's free.
Yeah. We'll get you a free replacement if we can take your Norway down.
Yeah. Or you could get like grants from the EMTs in the neighborhood. So
yeah.
The trees don't fall on people.
Yeah.
You two could just keep brainstorming forever on this, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
I understand your
business is expanding. You're doing meadows and you're doing soil management. Tell us about those services as well as tree service.
Last year, I started New Leaf Ecological Landscapes. I've really been inspired, dating back to about 5 years ago, by what's going on in regenerative agriculture. You know, these books like The Soil Will Save Us and Dirt to Soil by Gabe Brown, they really got me going in this kind of concept of what's alive in the soil and what turns dirt into soil, you know, what makes it alive. And then how does that connect and relate to trees? My office manager, Linda Borton, took a soil class with this esteemed biologist, Elaine Ingham, and she's been able to bring that type of information into our practice. We do a lot with mycorrhizal fungi inoculation into the soil. I know you have Dave Newman on from Arthur's Point in the past. We're big fans of his probiotic biochar soil amendment. We use that with all of our plantings to amend the soil and inoculate the trees at planting. So that those beneficial elements are in the soil that will help the trees establish and expand their potential for absorbing or finding and absorbing water and nutrients at a faster rate. So the development of our landscaping company was kind of birthed from that concept. I was very fortunate to be able to hire a local landscape designer, Deborah Wren, this spring, who is going to take over the operational management of that wing of our business this year. And we're going to be doing landscape maintenance, design, and installations, all fully focused on natives. Now, if you have a garden that you would like to talk to us about that isn't fully native, but you are interested in converting it over time, that also is something that we would really like to help with. And then the meadow element is also something that has been very interesting to me for the last couple of years.
There's a huge interest in meadows, and there's a right way to do them and a wrong way, right? Or there's probably many right ways.
I think that's true. I think, I've learned a lot in the last 2 years, and then can also strip it down and go, oh my God, what did I just learn and what do I actually know now? Because yes, there are a lot of different opinions on the right way to go about it. And I think when it comes down to it, you know, the main challenges with converting a lawn to a meadow are trying to eliminate the grasses that you have and create a space that is then accepting of the new seeds and will minimize the weeds that will grow up in that while those new seeds establish. We've been working on our process. I don't know if it'll ever be fully developed. I think we'll always be learning when it comes to that. Meadows offer so many more environmental benefits. Lawns are really almost the worst thing you can do short of a parking lot in your landscape from an ecological perspective.
Now, Doug Tallamy is the guru of all nativists. And he's got a guy that's nipping at his heels saying, oh, no, you're such a purist, you know, you shouldn't be against anything that's not native. And I'm hearing you say that you will come in and correct somebody's garden from having non-natives. But I like my iris and my daffodils and all my non-natives. Why can't they coexist? Why can't they just get along?
Yeah, I think they can. I think at the core of what Doug Tallamy is teaching is this concept that our native insect populations drive our entire ecology here. Without them in full force and in good quantity of numbers, you can't really overstate it. I mean, it's not just the birds or the plants that need bees to pollinate them. It's that everything above them in that chain cannot survive if they are not there. And our native insects have not adapted to eat the non-native plant material because that evolution can take hundreds of years. So when we talk about Norway maples as an example of a non-native that I said that we should put a bounty on, it's because, you know, if you look at them in the summer, nothing's eating them. And I think that that can be a foreign concept. And I really enjoy educating my customers on this. I think most people would look at an oak tree and see some holes in it and think, oh my God, what's wrong with my oak? But the reality is that oaks support the most caterpillars of any species of plant by far and are the most valuable in our landscape for that reason. Whereas, you know, Norway maples just don't. Not only that, but they also shade everything out underneath them. So the short answer is, of course they can coexist. There can be spaces for both. I think really staying away from the more invasive of the non-natives is what's most important. You know, those Bradford pears, the Norway maples, things that will take over an area, the multiflora rose, bittersweet, trying to control those things.
Burning bush.
Yeah, and that's a really tough one because I have a lot of clients who love their burning bush. But at the same time, if you walk in the forest around some, they're everywhere.
Even if you didn't plant them, if your neighbor planted them, they're there. Yeah.
Japanese barberry. Yeah. I mean, it takes off through these forests.
So I'm going to break into this rogues gallery here for a minute. And Tim's going to hear something from me that he's never heard.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Perennials, ornamentals, small-scale stuff is okay in moderation. I said that out loud, moderation.
I don't understand your comment.
That we don't want to eradicate all of the non-natives that are there in...
Oh, I never...
In this pursuit of a totally native landscape.
I'm never someone who says get rid of all your non-natives because, you know, some things are really attractive. And as long as they're neutral and they don't spread or go into the woods or anything like that, I have irises in my flower beds. I have peonies in my flower beds. I even have a ginkgo tree, which I think is fine because it's not invasive. It just doesn't do anything. They're just ornamental. As long as people understand they're ornamental and they don't really have that much benefit to wildlife, it's all about opportunity costs, really. You know, if you plant a ginkgo, you can't plant an oak.
So as long as people understand that these aliens are merely ornamental and don't serve a purpose... Because what I think I'm hearing, is to get back to the basis of it, is all this drumbeat about we must have natives because they do so much good. Like, okay, fine. A little bit of ornamental here and there.
It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're on the same page, Gene, if you can believe that.
Of course, we're still arguing, you notice.
We have a point and counterpoint here, I think, always, right?
Yeah.
We always ask this question at the end, what gives you hope out there? Because a lot of times we'll talk to people about invasives and all the, and, you know, jumping worms and all these bad things. And at the end, we always want to know, like, what gives you hope when you're out there talking to customers and seeing people and out in Columbia County?
I would say that overwhelmingly, the concepts that we've talked today, people are very receptive to them. You know, often we'll get called because someone says, I need to spray my trees. And we'll go out and we'll look at them and we can have that conversation and kind of explain, well, if we spray the trees for this, there is the potential that we're going to kill, you know, these other things or that it could have collateral damage. Maybe, maybe not, but let's at least have this conversation. I think that that is constantly happening with the native, non-native invasive conversation. I think with climate, that is also happening. People are very conscious in general of these concepts. And so while they may have called me to come give a cost to remove a tree, they're open to the conversation for keeping it if there is a different option that can still satisfy their goals and needs on the property. So that gives me hope, is that people are receptive and interested in learning.
What's your favorite tree?
Great question. Oaks have been a favorite of mine for a long time.
And what species?
Well, the red and white, I really enjoy the bark and the branch structure on the white. I will say the pin oak has recently become more of a favorite to me when given proper attention. It was pointed out to me in some pruning books that I've been reading that pin oaks actually are the most likely to produce a strong central leader. What has always bothered me about pin oaks is the cluttered mess that is usually present in the lower half to third of the canopy. So what I mean when I say with proper attention, with some pruning, those can be cleaned up and can have some really beautiful structure. And then lately, well, sugar maple's been a favorite just because I always like to make maple syrup with my kids and all that. But, you know, the American linden basswood And then the Eastern Redbud. Lately, I've just been all about the Redbud. It's just been so beautiful driving around the county and in the early spring and seeing that color.
The native.
Good pollinator plant, yes. Too. Yeah.
I like the native better than a lot of the hybrids.
Yeah.
They've
yeah.
gone nutty yeah. with the hybrids.
Yeah. And I mean, American Linden, too, the basswood, just the scent that comes off of that right around the 4th of July is.
And they sing in the spring.
Yeah.
They're so full
all
of
bees. All right, I'm going to buy it. I don't have one. I'm going to buy Get a one. Basswood.
You're going to yeah. love it. You want to read us your website so that we can put that on the air?
Sure. You can find us online at newleaftreeservices.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been great. We really learned a lot.
And we're bringing you back, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I think we're going to kidnap him to come back and talk about other tree things. Thanks, Caleb.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.